Folks, when I get up at 5:30 in the morning on a Sunday to talk to somebody who's across the jolly old pond and 5 or 6 hours ahead of me, you know the subject material is going to be something that I find interesting. Otherwise, I would definitely be in bed, especially on the first NFL Sunday of the year. Instead, I absolutely just had to make time for today's guest, who I find fascinating, and I hope that you will as well. Before we get started, I want to shout out my patrons. Patrons are people that make this podcast possible. We'll get through a little housekeeping, and then we will be on our way uninterrupted with the interview. First and foremost, my friends over at the Sanlucci Steam Room. The Sanlucci Steam Room are a group of traders that are experts in options flow. They are experts in tape reading. They are experts in market psychology, and right now, they are offering something called the 3LT Playbook, which is the three rules that Lucci has used to become the seven-figure trader that he is today. I've known these guys 6 or 7 years. They are great guys. They know what they're doing. The link to that is in my podcast description. Also, a link to their master course that they are offering. Secondly, this podcast is brought to you by my friends over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a brand new investor education and investor advocacy service where it's set up for day traders and by day traders. You're going to get watch lists. You're going to get education. You're going to get live streams. You're going to get daily chat rooms. And you're going to be able to communicate with Pete, who is the man that set up the Trader's Path after defecting from other day trading services that he hated, the kind that you see advertised on YouTube ubiquitously. So go hang out with my friend Pete over at the Trader's Path and check out a trading service where they're not trying to screw you over or front run your trades. Link to them is in my podcast description. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends over at Rumorhound. Rumorhound.ai is a brand new innovative piece of AI-based software that is going to help you distinguish which merger and acquisition rumors you see where, on Twitter, in the news, in your chat rooms, are worth following. It uses a proprietary piece of software to examine things like the source of the rumor, the viability of the proposed merger, and numerous other variables to then turn around and try to tell you whether or not it's something while you're trading during that day that you may or may not want to pay attention to. It's a great tool to have in your arsenal. You could check them out in the podcast description, rumorhound.ai. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Focused Compounding. Focused Compounding is a group of traders, and all they do is try to seek out trades that nobody else in the market is looking at. You could check them out on Twitter at Focused Compound, and the link to their YouTube channel and their website are both in my podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Hella Bacon that shoot machine guns out of helicopters in Texas, my friends at Corvus Gold, Piggly Wiggly, Russ Valenti, Matt Zimmer, Nick Parks, Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground and Traders for a Cause, Chris Bede, Ken R., and Chris Boas, as well as some of my newest patrons, Stephen G., David Greiner, Paul Porter, Ray Myers, Want2XL, Wojtek, Jonathan Elliott, Tom K2, Thomas Liberty, my friends over at the hashtag Fannygate Movement are in the house, Casey Ponder, Charles Zivkiniv, Krid Karanoff, King Combo, Dylan West, Stephen Boppel, my friends Edward Zavides checked in on PayPal, my brother LWS Consumer Products. Oh, I know you. You're not a patron. That's my merch guy. All right. Well, whoever you are, thank you for sending me money. Last but not least, some people that have been patrons with me for a while, like Straight Cash Homie, Patrick T. Flynn, my brother Paul B., L, I don't know if you want me to say your last name, but, you know, my old Herbalife homeboy. Brian Holloway, Malte Daniels, Andrew Lidner, Money Lobster's in the house. Chi-Chi's from the Coconut, still here, checking in from Hawaii. Elon's Doobie, Mahalo Heiler, Dylan Smith, Peter Masso, what's going on? Okay. Two other things before we get started. I do recommend a 2-drink minimum for this podcast. This one I find fascinating, folks. This is the one you pour a little scotch or a little brandy into a snifter. You put on your bathrobe and you sit back in your chair like fucking Hugh Hefner and you just take this podcast in top to bottom. So if you're going to be participating in the 2-drink minimum, and I know you are, by the way, some of you probably haven't even gotten home from the bar last night yet. It's 5:30 in the morning right now. I would recommend some type of cognac for this one, folks, because we're going down the rabbit hole today and I'm fired up about it. Finally, last but not least, this podcast is not financial advice. I'm not a registered anything. I hold no licenses, no registrations, and best This podcast isn't even about finance, so if you lose money trading on something in this podcast, then it's really your own damn fault. Today, I am fascinated to have with me Gerard Williams. Gerard Williams is an international journalist and historian with an esteemed career spanning over 30 years. He just told me 40 years. Sorry, so I'll correct myself there, Gerard, before you correct me. His resume includes acting as duty editor for Reuters, the BBC, and Sky News. His groundbreaking reporting has taken him to the front lines of the fall of the Soviet Union, the Rwandan genocide, the 2004 tsunami in Thailand, and the U.S. occupation of Iraq, among many other international stories. 10 years ago, while reporting in Argentina, Williams came across evidence in a local archive that changed the way he looked at historical reporting. Nazi war criminals, potentially including Adolf Hitler, used clandestine international routes to flee defeated Germany for safe haven in Argentina and other South American countries. Using these archives, eyewitness reports, and other local histories, Williams published the book Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. Despite the rigor in his journalism and his adherence to facts and evidence, the international community has largely ignored him. Today, with the release of classified FBI and OSS documents, his work is finally getting the credit and the respect that it deserves. So what I will say is, I first saw Mr. Williams on a Netflix series called Conspiracy, or Conspiracies, one of the two. It's currently on Netflix now here in the States. I'm not sure if it is across the pond where Mr. Williams is. I assume that it is. And it's a mini-series with about 10 or 12 episodes that document, you know, generally some of the conspiracy theories that you often hear, you know, which are like the moon landing and other things that I don't necessarily lend a ton of credence to. But there was an episode on the Nazis and the death of Hitler. I actually believe it's episode 1 in the series. And it is a fascinating look at whether or not Hitler died in the fashion that history tells us he died. And so here to talk about that is Mr. Gerard Williams. How are you?
Hi, Chris. Thanks very much for having me on the show. And please, it's Gerard. Mr. Williams makes me feel very old.
Gerard, okay, you got it. Well, I called you Jerry by accident in our introductory chat, so I apologize for that.
No problem.
So
one of the strangest scenes I've ever come across, and you're right, it is now 41 years since I've been an international, mainly television journalist, for some of the biggest news agencies in the world, and some of the most respected broadcasters in the world as well. I was in Argentina doing a bunch of documentaries for people like Channel 4 in this country and Al Jazeera International as they launched, and came across this story that Adolf Hitler had escaped from the ruins of Berlin and had lived out his life in Argentina. And I thought to myself, because this was 30 years into doing hard news, that I'd do a silly story. For the first time ever, I would do a conspiracy theory story about Adolf Hitler getting on a submarine and ending up living his life in the Andes. And so, first time I'd ever even considered doing a silly film or a silly story. And then I started to look at it and started to go into the information that is available to anybody out there, including historians who have ignored it all. And it started to become frighteningly real. And I use the term frighteningly, you know, in a sensible way. It was scary to actually find out that there was so much information that Adolf Hitler had not died in the bunker in Berlin, had not committed suicide. Eva Braun had not committed suicide either. And that both of them, and God knows how many other top Nazis, managed to make it out of Berlin and by submarine in some cases and by normal ships in other cases, made it to Argentina and Brazil to live out their lives, not hunted, just live out their lives in Argentina.
So for the listener that doesn't really know the story very well, what's the official explanation that history tells us, wrapping up, you know, the war and ultimately, you know, how Hitler died?
Right. Well, the quotes, official quotes, history says that Adolf Hitler was a physical wreck at the end of 1945. The Soviets were closing in on Berlin. The Allies, the Americans, the Canadians, and the British were on the River Elbe. They decided to let Stalin take Berlin. And seeing no way out at all, Adolf Hitler shot himself in the head at the same time as biting a cyanide pill. And Eva Braun also took a cyanide pill and killed herself. Their bodies were then taken up into the garden of the Führer bunker. Petrol was poured on them. They were set on fire. And that was the end of the leader of the Third Reich.
And so you were very... When leading up to doing the podcast, we had a discussion where I said, you know, tell me something about your thesis or something. And you were like, hey, this isn't a thesis. You know, I've been a journalist for 3 decades or 4 decades.
I don't do conspiracy theories, Chris. I mean, I never had done conspiracy theories. Most of the ones have been presented to me over the years, especially after I started doing this story, are things that I haven't had 10 or 12 years chance to investigate and sure. investigate. So if people have various views about various things, everything from 9/11 to the moon landings, as you said. I have no views on those whatsoever. I don't know because I haven't spent 12 years of my life looking at them. What I do know, after having spent a great deal of time on this story, and you know, I've been to Argentina 20 times, for goodness sake. What I do know is that Adolf Hitler did not die in the bunker in Berlin. There's no forensic evidence there. You know, Stalin said that he'd escaped. Marshal Zhukov, who was commanding Soviet forces in Berlin, said they had found no body. Eisenhower in the 1950s said, we hope he's dead, but we've got no proof that he was dead.
Right.
And a BBC reporter, Thomas Cadet, who was there embedded, we would call it nowadays, with Soviet troops as they took the bunker, said they had found a number of bad doubles of Hitler. But of Hitler himself, there was no sign whatsoever. Now, I have no idea, well, I do have an idea why these things have been ignored by historians over the years. Historians are lazy. And when somebody like Hugh Trevor Roper, the British academic who wrote the final account of Hitler's death, The Last Days of Adolf Hitler, after Hugh Trevor Roper had written that and it was published, historians simply go back to that as their base to work from. But if you look at Trevor Roper's information and Trevor Roper's investigation, it's flawed all over the place. It still strikes me as completely ridiculous that the Allied forces, Britain in this case, but Trevor Roper's account was accepted all over the world, chose an Oxford academic who had no police background, no detective credentials at all, to look into the death of the most evil man of the 20th century, in my personal opinion, although Stalin has to be up there as well. So they let a man who'd written a book about a British bishop sometime in the 15th century. He was the man who was chosen to do the case, not a senior New York PD, NYPD detective or a Scotland Yard detective or an MI5 or an OSS man. No, none of this. Some strange Oxford academic who was pretty much owned by the British establishment. And that's been the accepted story ever since. It's wrong. It's totally wrong. We have been lied to.
Who was he chosen by to prepare this?
British intelligence. He'd worked for British intelligence during World War II, looking at German messages coming in from Nazi war machine and deciding on whether or not they were of interest to the government. So not at Bletchley Park, not at the big code breakers, but it's just part of a very obscure department within MI5.
So and his what he produced is endorsed by the British government, is endorsed by British intelligence.
It was endorsed by the British government and British intelligence, and has been accepted by everybody else. What's funny though is that the people he said that he interviewed, one is Hannah Reich, Hitler's favorite female pilot, and the other one was von Bülow, who was one of the adjutants in the bunker. When they read the accounts of what Trevor Roper had said. They had said to him, when they'd stopped laughing, they just said the man is lying. Hannah Reich said she had never even met Trevor Roper. And it finally turns out that Trevor Roper wasn't allowed to meet with Hannah Reich. She was in American custody. And Hannah Reich's, they then handed over a redacted version of Hannah Reich's testimonies to Trevor Roper, which he worked on, and then said were his work, and he had interviewed her. And the same with von Bülow, the adjutant. He said he laughed every time he was asked about the last days of Adolf Hitler because he had never met Trevor Roper either. and that the material contained in the book was, as von Bulow said, lies. Straightforward lies.
So, you know, you have a little bit of a burden here, the way that this is set up, in the sense that, you know, my listeners, my podcast is primarily a financial podcast with some business, some politics. So my okay. my listener is not going to be familiar with the subject material.
Your listeners will be very, very familiar with the finances are the things behind wars. And your listeners will be very familiar, I hope, that huge American companies like IBM, Chase Manhattan, the Ford Motor Company, oh, and various others, too many to mention really, had large stakes and investments in Nazi Germany and were very, very involved in the creation of the Third Reich. They were also involved in what happened after World War II with all the money that the Nazis had nicked from Europe. I mean, there's an old saying in police work, and it's one that my co-author Simon Dunstan loved to quote, was follow the money. Well, right. We have followed the money. It went to Argentina en masse. It went to Argentina, not in strange shipments of gold and concentration camp teeth and things like that. It went out there simply by bank transfer via the Swiss banks at the time. The International Bank of Settlements, which your listeners will know of, in Basel, was also heavily involved. There was a large financial reason why the Nazis were allowed to escape. And I say allowed to escape because this was an American operation, the escape. It was run by Alan Dulles of OSS, who had known Martin Bormann, who was one of the key players probably on the German side in 1943 onwards. The Reichsleiter, the leader of the party. Dulles had sat next to Bormann at the Munich Olympics, for God's sake, the Berlin Olympics, and they had maintained contact ever since. It's really simple. The Germans had a great many things that America wanted at the end of World War II. Their rocketry was simply one of them. Their atomic research and their atomic fissile material, the stuff that makes bombs go bang in a very loud way, was all very much wanted by the Americans, who were massively keen not to see any of this end up in Soviet hands. So they did a deal with Martin Bormann, Adolf Hitler, and Gestapo Müller, the head of the Gestapo SS, and they said, "Okay, you give us what we want, and we'll let you go, and we'll never talk about it again." And they didn't talk about it again ever. John J. McCloy is the other key American in all this. And it's interesting for those who do love a conspiracy theory that Dulles and J.J. McCloy were both on the Warren Commission and Kennedy's death.
That's interesting. So, you know, you're basically saying, look, the Americans wanted some things that the Germans had, and it was a, you know, we scratch your back, you scratch ours, we'll kind of pay no mind.
Hey, the Nazis put you guys on the moon. It's a hard, you know, terrible thing to say, but Wernher von Braun and his team of rocket scientists put America on the moon, put the first people in space. Wernher von Braun was, the head of Hitler's missile program. If you read the official history of General Patton's Third Army, von Braun actually surrenders to Patton's tanks along with all of his scientists. The real truth behind this is that Commander Ian Fleming, the man who wrote the James Bond books, of all things, who was a very senior military intelligence operative in World War II for the British, Fleming had a bunch called 30 Assault Unit, who were known as Fleming's Red Indians, working behind German lines as Germany collapsed, working into areas which would eventually become Soviet-controlled. They picked up all of von Braun's team and took them to the Americans and handed them over. And they did this because Martin Bormann told Fleming, or via Alan Dulles, exactly where these scientists lived, where they would be hiding, where their information was. So they went and picked them up. It's not the fog of war. They were deliberately targeted and brought over to the Allied side. Wernher von Braun, people of my age in America would remember him appearing with Walt Disney and having what was called... It's called a Purcell Shine, where all information or facts about his involvement with the Nazi Party were simply washed out of history. But Wernher Braun was responsible for the deaths of over 30,000 people in Nazi camps, which were working on his rocket project, responsible for the deaths of thousands of people in London with the V1 and V2 rockets, and in Amsterdam and in Rotterdam at the end of World War II with V2 rockets as well. Wernher Braun was a dyed-in-the-wool bloody Nazi. Operation Paperclip, you got 10,000 scientists. And as part of that deal, you got not just 10,000 scientists, you also got a huge amount of uranium, which may well have been used in one of the bombs that was dropped on Japan, because you did not have that much fissile material, that's the stuff that makes a big bang, available to you in the Manhattan Project. And a shipload or a submarine load of this was delivered in the closing days of the war by Nazis to Plymouth, and waiting there was Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb. And again, this was not something that just happened. Oh gosh, oh look, we just luckily found a whole submarine full of refined uranium. No, this was part of the deal. This was part of the deal to enable Martin Bormann to get his beloved Führer and his girlfriend or wife at that stage, the mother of his two daughters anyway, out of Germany and into freedom in South America. Bormann had recognized that the war was lost from 1943 when the Germans were destroyed in the huge tank battle at Kursk by the Soviet forces. This is despite the Germans probably using battlefield nuclear weapons for the first time in history, one battlefield nuclear weapon, which destroyed a whole Soviet Guards division. And it's just, Bormann recognized it was all falling apart. He told German companies to move their patents, their capital, and everything else out to safe havens. Those safe havens were, to a lesser extent, Turkey, Syria, Egypt, Brazil, but mainly Argentina. Argentina was very, very pro-Nazi. They didn't even declare war on the Nazis until the very, very last moment in World War II. And Juan Perón was put into power by the Nazis in 1943. Eva Perón, the beloved Evita of that, you know, wonderful musical film, Evita was a Nazi sub-by from 1940. I've seen the check stubs that paid for her rent. It's not the truth that the truth, and you know, put that in inverted commas as well, Chris, before I ramble on forever.
No, please do.
The truth that we were told, it really isn't.
You know, just to go back to one thing that you just said that caught my ear immediately was, you know, when you said that the Nazis put the U.S. on the moon, you know, a big part of the moon landing conspiracy theory is we didn't have the technology at the time. Was, you know, at some point between when we started, I guess, with the initial Apollo 1 mission, which I know there's a bunch of conspiracy theories about as well, and the time we finally got on the moon, there was this great leap in technology that a lot of conspiracy theorists point to and say, you know, we don't really know how the hell they put this technology together in such a short amount of time.
Wernher Braun and his team had been working on the Saturn V launcher, the one that eventually got you into space, from the early 1940s on. I mean, they had been developing an America rocket. If they had developed an America rocket, they had poison, anthrax, and various horrible diseases that they could have dropped on the island of Manhattan, but they also had nukes. And this information is only just coming out about their nuclear program. Everybody's poo-pooed it in the past. But there is just too much information available now to think that the Germans didn't have nukes at the end of World War II. They weren't very good nukes, and they were probably like, you know, the terrorist dirty suitcase bombs we've all been warned of over the years, but enough to probably set Manhattan alight if they could have got it there in a sensible delivery system.
So walk my listeners through how this comes to be with you and how you start to kind of piece things together.
Well, I started to get a bit annoyed, really, and it's a very dangerous place for me to be as a journalist, to get annoyed, because when I started to look at the death of Adolf Hitler, none of what I'd been taught made sense. None of it. You know, we have testimony from the pilot who flew them out, who eventually ended up in America, and his son flew jets in Vietnam for the US, Pete Baumgart, who gave his testimony in a Warsaw course in the 40s. I've interviewed people personally, four or five people in Argentina and in London, who have all seen Adolf Hitler after the war, living in Argentina, attending various events and with his wife, Eva, at that stage. BBC reporters, and I think that's what did it for me, right? Is if you go back and look at the journalism at the time, it doesn't fit in with any of the history. Time magazine quotes an NKVD, Russian Secret Service officer, who's being interviewed by them at the Führer Bunker and the Chancellery in Berlin. Major Nicotine shows the town correspondent the door that opens up into a tunnel that leads to the German, the Berlin Underground system. He shows them a letter from Eva Braun to her parents saying, "You won't hear from me for a while." Nicotine admits that they have found no corpses that could be Adolf Hitler or Eva Braun. They found lots of corpses, and they've actually been handed over. I think it's 8 doubles of Hitler, one of whom the Soviets dismissed because he's wearing socks that have been repaired, darned, we'd call it in Britain, and they don't think that the leader of the Third Reich would ever have worn darned socks. But none of them were good enough to convince anybody that they were Adolf Hitler. So I started to read reports from the BBC, from Time magazine, from UPI, from the Associated Press, all people I've either worked for or relied on for factual information in my career as an international journalist. And when you start putting these together, the interviews they did with Eisenhower and Zhukov and things Stalin said, and you just look at it and you think, good God, why is none of this reported? I mean, it was reported at the time, so why has this all been ignored?
Right.
Because it's not like one smoking gun, you know? What it is a whole avalanche of information that's available out there of exactly what was reported on at the time. And having been a reporter myself for, you know, 41 years, I just made 61, I started in 19, 61 in March, sorry. I would trust these guys on the ground a lot more. This isn't a generation of fake news or whatever it's called nowadays in America, and to a certain extent over here. This is a generation of reporters who are trusted, who right. do their properly, and it's extremely difficult to actually get a story out on a wire if you're working for the Associated Press or for Reuters or whatever else. You know, there'll be 5 or 6 editorial processes that it has to go through. So if it actually makes it through those processes and out on the wire, in the 1940s, you could trust this information. I mean, some of it's obviously propaganda. And, you know, we have details of how America and the British used propaganda and used false agencies. But none of this comes from false agencies. This comes from people who are seriously respected within their own profession, and who go on after the war to have glittering careers, and yet their information has been ignored completely.
Yeah, it's not like it is now, where you can just put something out on Twitter and then that crosses the wire, and you know everybody goes back to your Twitter tweet and then cites that as, you know, their source. I mean, you're saying the editorial bar was much higher.
There was an editorial bar. I mean, there isn't one on Twitter. It's why I don't tweet. It's the most ridiculous medium in the world. And how America can run its foreign policy on the tweets from the White House is beyond me. It's not an America I recognize in any way, shape, or form. But that's a completely different thing. I'll get accused of being a Democrat soon.
So what was the so walk us through kind of the early stages and what some of the inflection points were for you going through this story, the first couple of years that you really started to kind of sink your teeth into it?
Well, I did quite a lot of traveling around in Argentina to places that just looked German. Bariloche, or San Carlos de Bariloche, down in the Andes, which is now a major winter sports destination, was basically Nazi central. There were dozens of senior Nazis there, SS, Luftwaffe officers, military officers there who had fled after the war. Some of them wanted war criminals, some of them not. Some of them who just had enough and had gone to Argentina. But Argentina welcomed them with open arms. Perón thought that this injection of educated Europeans into his growing country would help a great deal. What it was not an injection of educated human beings. It was an injection of Nazi fascist poison that still poisons Argentina to this day, and turned what could have been one of the greatest, most productive countries in the world into an economic basket case. But again, that's another story, one I've looked at a great deal over the years. And it was just meeting people. You go to Argentina and, you know, you talk about the story and people go, oh yeah, yeah, no problems with that whatsoever. You know, I grew up with the children of SS officers who had come here in 1946, 47, and were in school with me. You know, everybody knew that Argentina was the place that Adolf Hitler and Martin Bormann fled to. And for a while, you just sit there and go, oh, come on, give me a break. You know, nobody just knows. And they go, okay, well, I know somebody who's seen him. I know somebody who my parents knew. I'd give you just one little snapshot story. I produced a drama documentary in Argentina, 140 people working on it, Argentine actors, film crew, makeup artists, you know, props people, the lot. Wonderful guys, brilliant crew, wonderful actors. And at the end of it, the head of our makeup department, a man called Oscar Moulet. Oscar is the only Oscar-nominated Argentine makeup artist. Oscar had gone off to do a commercial for BMW in Paraguay. And he had been taken out to dinner by the head of BMW in Paraguay. And so at the dinner after the shoot, you know, everybody's very happy with it and everything else. Oscar's sitting there chatting to the guy from BMW, and he says to Oscar, so what have you been working on? Oscar said, I've been working on this film about Adolf Hitler living in Argentina after World War II. And the guy from BMW said, oh yeah, my parents knew them quite well when they were here.
Yeah, just like that, huh?
Just, I mean, just like
very matter-of-factly.
Yeah, you know, I've met somebody who's a, you know, third cousin of the Kennedys, or, you know,
right,
whatever. But it not in any way that would be disputed. Oh yeah, my parents knew them quite well when they were here.
Well, it's interesting because you said before. You know, well, he had been seen out and about, and you know, him and Ava had been seen out and about. I mean, so is it your? From what you found, is it your impression that even while he was there, it wasn't like this? It wasn't like being kept under wraps. I mean, did he change his appearance?
He was kept under wraps, but in a very, very tight German community. You know, there was a big Nazi party in Argentina before World War II. Not quite as big as the Nazi party in America before World War II, the Bund, which is seriously scary. But there was a big Nazi party in Argentina before World War II. And a huge German colony. I mean, you could disappear in Argentina if you were a German. And if you were the Führer, you actually were able. You'd have a lot of people who were very, very supportive of you. You had brought with you, or Martin Bormann had brought with him, billions of dollars worth of money and patents and inventions and everything else, which were very helpful to the Argentine economy for a little while. I mean, Bormann actually supplied country buying money in Argentina. And yes, Hitler could pretty much, within this tight community where they would be able to spot an outsider like that, Hitler could pretty much do whatever he wanted to do. But Hitler wasn't the figure within the post-war Nazis that he was in pre-war Nazis. Martin Bormann, a very clever man, recognized that the whole swastika, Hugo Boss uniforms and polished boots thing was never going to work again. So he also realized that the idea of having this demigod leader was never going to work again.
Right.
So Bormann concentrated on the politicians who owed him favors in Germany and the industrialists who owed him favors in Germany, and that he had enough information to have them put away if he needed to. Borman's links with Alan Dulles and John J. McCloy were incredibly deep. And they were able to get away with pretty much with anything in Latin America and also in West Germany at the end of the war. I mean, the more information, I've been looking at doing a follow-up to Grey Wolf called The Spider's Web, which is how the Nazis pretty much won the Cold War. Because after World War II, German intelligence, which was completely officered by SS and Wehrmacht officers who worked for the Nazis in the war, was America's first point of contact with the Soviet Union. And West German intelligence lied consistently to the Americans about how bad the Soviets were, about how well equipped the Soviets were and everything else. So America was made to deflect its attention to the Soviet Union and the Cold War, which affected everybody of my generation. And at the same time, Germany was allowed to rebuild. West Germany in those days was allowed to rebuild. The German economic miracle happened. There was no economic miracle, just the money came back in. They shipped it overseas, and then they transferred their assets back into Germany. And that's what rebuilt West Germany at the end of World War II. So you're in a situation where the Nazis were still running Germany after World War II. There was no serious denazification program at all. John J. McCloy just let all the industrialists go after they'd served 3 or 4 years. There were very few executions by the Allies, very few. Many of the top people in the first West German democratic government had held senior positions within the Nazi government at the same time. And they continued to make policy. And Martin Bormann was pulling the strings, mainly from Argentina, although he did visit Spain regularly, as did many German politicians who he would meet up with on a regular basis to discuss the future of the country. It's really sickening. The more I read, the more I look at it, the more angry I get. My dad was a combat soldier in World War II. He joined up in September 39, fought his way through the desert. He was a desert rat, and then fought his way up through Italy and was wounded 3 times, made regimental sergeant major. But if my dad had survived to read what I had written in Grey Wolf, he'd have gone looking for a rifle. He'd want to shoot people. That whole great generation, both the American and Canadian and British generation that fought for liberty for us, was betrayed horribly at the end of World War II. And their sons and daughters continue to be betrayed by the same people, or the same shadow government that you do have in America. What Kennedy and Eisenhower referred to, I think, as the military-industrial complex. They're the guys who did the deal with the Nazis post-World War II, and they're the guys who still do the deals today.
So in addition to, you know, going on the ground in Argentina, where else did your research take you, kind of moving on from there?
I've been to Berlin, where interviewed by various news organizations there, none of them German, interestingly. And where numerous German historians refused to meet me in open debate, which I found very strange, because, you know, if they wanted to make me look silly, surely they'd be able to make me look silly.
Sure.
And just knock down the information. But nobody has ever bothered to try and do that. They've all just gone on in print if they have. Oh, the man's an idiot, conspiracy theorist. You know, this is all ridiculous, but they never come up with anything which says, and we can prove this because we've got Adolf Hitler's skull and we've got Adolf Hitler's teeth. Well, they don't. And that was proved by an American DNA expert for, I think, the Discovery Channel about 8 years ago, where he tested the blood from the sofa that the Soviets say Hitler shot himself on. And the DNA he got there was from a woman.
From a woman, right. Yeah, I remember that from the documentary. And
she was too old to be Adolf Hitler's girlfriend, Eva Braun. So it couldn't have been Eva Braun's blood. So there are no forensics whatsoever. And yeah, I think it's just the question of, I really hate being lied to. I mean, it's one of those things you come across regularly as a journalist. You know, I did 2.5 years during the Yugoslav war out of Serbia. And you're constantly lied to by Serbian politicians, militia leaders, whatever. You know, you confront them and say, but why did your troops throw all those grenades in the cellars full of women and children? Oh, we wouldn't do a thing like that. But I have video of it. You know, in the days when you couldn't fake video. And loads and loads of occasions where I've caught out politicians. You know, I've interviewed a number of UN Secretary Generals in my time, interviewed, oh, God knows how many presidents were around the world, and 15 African presidents at one stage. And you can tell when people are lying. And I really don't like being lied to. You know, call me old-fashioned, because I am. I'm old-fashioned about the principles of journalism. And many of them are set up by really good journalists in America, you know, post-World War II, people I have intense respect for, Vietnam War reporters, people who reported the Korean War, which is the forgotten war for both America and the United Kingdom, and people today who are still left, you know, like Dan Rather. I mean, I have a huge amount of respect for Dan, massive amount of respect. The guy's a proper reporter. I know he hates the current administration. Doesn't hate it, he just reports on it, which is good. But you can't blame him, because he's reported on so many other administrations, which he wasn't always impressed with as well. But so there was a great tradition of proper reporting in America. And we have a similar thing in the UK, but not quite, for me, as open and as good as US reporting had been. Especially in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. So when you get lied to by people, because of where I come from, where I'm trained, I'm an agency journalist by training, you dig deeper.
Right.
I mean, you know, I've had numerous of my eyewitnesses threatened with death by Nazis. They'd never threatened me. Although I've had a few dodgy conversations with people over my time doing this who've told me to back off, but you know, I'm not going to back off.
Yeah, it's interesting too, this day and age, because I was just having a discussion last week with somebody talking about, you know, the content that I choose to put out on my podcast and the things that I choose to explore, and you know, kind of stick to this or stick to that, and you know, why try to cross lines? Why try to walk up to lines? And the, you know, I don't like being lied to either. It's part of the reason that I started my podcast about the financial world, is because, you know, I found an entire angle to the world of finance that wasn't being covered in any of the mainstream media. And just when the media chooses not to cover it, or like you're saying, academics, especially in the world of finance also too, choose not to cover it, what happens is people that are getting their education in the topic come out indoctrinated. And like you said earlier, everybody kind of points back to this one document that's produced, or this one textbook that's produced, or this one, you know, this one piece of information, one piece of material. And then when somebody comes along and kind of challenges that piece of material, they're immediately disregarded as a crackpot, when, you know, there are a fair amount of crackpots out there. But I certainly take no issue with trying to examine, right? Try to go to that source and examine the source that's being used. And if you have something to bring to the table to challenge it, to take a look at it.
People who don't have an open mind, because, I mean, when Sterling, who are, you know, one of the biggest publishers in America, they're wholly owned by Barnes & Noble. When Sterling very courageously, in my view, decided to take on Grey Wolf, they put us through the most rigorous editorial process you can imagine. But they were so pleased with what they had delivered, they put it out as history. They didn't put it out as fiction. They didn't put it out as conspiracy theory. At the bottom of the spine, it says history, and that's where this belongs, is in the history part of any library. People can poo-poo it, as we would say in Britain, probably a bit of an archaic term. People can say, oh, that's ridiculous, that's just stupid, he shot himself in the bunker. All I would say to those people is that the subtitle of Grey Wolf is The Case Presented, and that's what we did. And that's what I've been doing ever since, is presenting the case from the information that I've had. I'm not somebody who sits alone in his bedroom making this damn stuff up. Everything in Grey Wolf, the book, has at least two sources. And if it's not two sources and we've only got one source, we make it very clear that this is one source information. And you decide, as the reader, whether or not you think this is viable or true. There's nothing in there which, you know, says, oh, and then they went to the moon. Because, you know, I haven't got the information the Nazis had UFO flying saucers that enabled them to go to the moon. You know, I just don't have that information because it's not out there. It's made up by people, like the huge complexes in Antarctica. It's made up information. There is nothing to base it on, nothing at all to base it on. So, you know, I get these people who go, oh, you know, I know that I'm probably Adolf Hitler's daughter. Turns out to be a lady of color from Sweden in her 20s. Yeah, oh God, the amount of gopher holes you go down. Story, you know, the number of dead ends you hit doing this story, are huge, because people will make things up. Well, I'm not like our current Prime Minister in Britain, who made up things as a journalist and was fired on a number of occasions for it. I've never made up a story in my life, ever. And I stand by my reputation as a journalist. Completely. I mean, you know, I always think that that's what I was trained to do. It's who, why, what, where, and when. And, you know, they're the things that have stuck with me all my life. And I have to say, you know, I've made no damn money out of Grey Wolf. In fact, it's cost me a great deal, including my home, my marriage, and various other things, because it's become such a huge part of my life. In fact, I've been trying to step away from it, but unfortunately I can't step away from it because there is still so much out there to tell people about. Even if they don't want to listen, that's fine. I don't care if I, you know, I'm not go down in history, I'm not that important. But all I care about is that anybody who reads the material that I produce or the interviews that I do, like with good people like you, Chris, will actually just go, hang on, I should have a look at this. If they're interested, they should have a look at it and not just accept the professed truth from the establishment in 1945, because they lied. We were lied to. We've been lied to for 75 years. And for some reason, those lies continue.
Well, it, you know, it's not going to be a, you're not going to be telling my listeners anything new in telling them that they need to kind of examine the facts themselves and draw their own conclusion, and whether, because, you know, that's a lot of what I talk about on this podcast, and a lot of the guests that I bring on, you know, it's similarly situated types of scenarios where, you know, I felt like in this case, this was just something where, you know, I've been very impassioned by projects. I haven't worked on, you know, one project for 10, 12 years like you have, but I understand the feeling.
For God's sake, don't do it.
I understand the feeling, though, of wanting to, you know, first off, not being able to get away from it, number one, but number two, also just wanting to get it out there so that it's out there. And like you said, you're not aiming to be some great historical figure. I mean, obviously, if I can get in touch with you on Facebook, you know, over the last 2 weeks and just book you on a whim, you know, it's not as if you're on some major book signing tour or something. You know, hopefully you will be in the future. But I understand the.
I mean, you know, I will talk to fellow reporters, fellow journalists. I will be happy to involve myself in conversations with loads of people. So if any of your viewers, sorry, listeners, want to find me on Facebook, I'm Gerard Williams, G-E-R-R-A-R-D, Williams on Facebook. And if they want to mail me, they can mail me at Gerard Williams, G-E-R-R-A-R-D, Williams, or one word, at google.com. I don't hide from anything.
Well, you'll probably wind up getting some emails, I'm sure.
I don't always answer. It depends on how they're phrased. I like people to be polite.
Right.
And also, you know, if you have a business, if you have business audience out there, I'm looking for finance guys. There's a major feature film to be made here. There's probably a major 12-part Netflix series to be made here. And if anybody's interested in getting involved, based on what has become a best-selling book, Grey Wolf has sold over 100,000 copies in English and has sold in 17 or 18 countries worldwide. Hunting Hitler, which we don't necessarily need to go into here, ran for 28 episodes, three seasons, and was broadcast in 140 territories worldwide. So there is an audience out there for it. And if anybody fancies helping me finance it, I'm willing to talk.
Well, the interesting thing is, going back to what you said about you got to go down a lot of rabbit holes and you got to go down, you know, a lot of dead ends to try to find material as you're researching this. I mean, it's one of the most well-known stories in human history, which means that, you know, the base of people that you know about it and may want to comment on it, regardless of whether or not they have anything worthwhile to say, is probably immense. Which probably made it that much more difficult. I wanted to ask, I wanted to kind of turn around one more time back to some of the evidence that you had uncovered. In addition to going to Argentina, what types of what types of documents, photographs, you had mentioned earlier, pay stubs, letters, things that you can put your hands on. That are tangible, that are, you know, dated to that time. Did you come across?
In terms of Argentina and the involvement of the Perons, Eva and Juan Perón later being the president, there's a wonderful book by a Democratic congressman at the time called Santander, called A Tradition of Treachery, which contains photocopies, mimeographs there in those days, of the check stubs paid to Eva Braun for the rental of her property in Buenos Aires, in Recoleta. If any of your people know BA, they'll know that Recoleta is one of the most lovely parts of town. And various other information, documents from the German embassy in Buenos Aires at the time, detailing the relationships between the Perons and the Nazi intelligence operation. Then there are all the FBI documents which are available to people. I mean, for some reason, people think these only came out recently. They've been out for about 12 years. There are also CIA documents available, which talk about Hitler being in Argentina or in Paraguay. The CIA have not released as much as the FBI documents did. But the FBI documents, as we have learned to say, are heavily redacted. But they're still bloody interesting. Excuse my language. That's extremely interesting. You cut that in.
Okay, we curse a lot on this show. Don't worry about it.
Fair enough. I've been trying not to.
Please do.
But I've also spent hours at the archives in London, and military history archives. I've spent time in Berlin. I've spent time in Buenos Aires going through the archives there. Although, funny enough, a lot of them were burnt in the 1960s and 70s, so the information isn't available. I work very closely with the umbrella group for Jewish organizations in Argentina, who've been chasing Nazis for a very long time, although I'm not Jewish myself. I've met people who met members of Hitler's staff. One of the most telling was an Argentine congressman who'd written a book in the 1960s called Hitler Lived in Argentina or Died in Argentina. In Spanish, and Captain Monasterio, who had been interviewed by the CIA after his book had been published in Argentina. And I spoke to the captain at length, and he had lengthy interviews with Adolf Hitler's personal physician, who had treated him while he was in Argentina and had been there at his deathbed on February the 12th, 1962, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, you know, take that for what you believe it is, but the Captain Monasterio is a former commercial shipping captain, a congressman in Argentina. He represented the Disney organization in Argentina for many, many years in film, and is a very serious man. When various people had heard that Captain Monasterio was talking to us, he had a phone call at home saying, if you don't stop talking to these damn British people, we will burn your house down and kill your children. He doesn't scare easily, but I mean, we took that death threat to the hate crimes unit of the Buenos Aires police, the Argentine National Police, who took it extremely seriously. I've had people in this country, in the United Kingdom, who who have been doing research alongside me, sometimes for me, but sometimes for themselves, who've received death threats from neo-Nazi groups in Germany by letter and email. Why would you bother to threaten somebody with death about a story that wasn't true? Why? I don't understand that.
Yeah, and didn't the FBI actually release after Hitler had proclaimed or was proclaimed to have killed himself? Didn't they release documents and sketches of what he may look like because they believed that he might? Go ahead.
Yeah, they did. They did a whole load of what we would now call Photoshop material of what Adolf Hitler may have looked like if he'd escaped. I'm pretty sure that came from OSS, CIA, not the FBI, but you may be right. But Hoover, of FBI fame, Hoover never believed the guy was dead. And, you know, Hoover was in some ways kept out of the Dulles, J.J. McCloy, military industrial CIA cabal. But Hoover, I'm pretty sure, went to his deathbed believing that Adolf Hitler had escaped. He had agents looking for him all the time, and it stops in 1962. And it stops in 1962 because Hitler's dead. They're still looking for Martin Bormann until 1971. Martin Bormann is running everything anyway. I mean, he is the real Führer. He is the leader of the party post-war. And they're still looking for Bormann until at least the 70s, which is when I think he died. Now, the thing is, you know, when they left, they took unimaginable amounts of money. I mean, a third of the treasures, you know, the art treasures that the Nazis stole have never been recovered, plus billions and billions and billions of dollars in everything from share certificates to insurance policies to whatever else they could steal from various people, not just the Jews, but, you know, Polish intellectuals, everything else. That money went somewhere. It didn't just disappear at the end of World War II. I mean, your financial people will know money does not disappear. You can lose it on a market, but somebody's made it somewhere.
Right.
You know, and that money was transferred overseas and hidden, and then was transferred back into Germany in the 1930s to create the German economic miracle and to make Germany, you know, the supreme player in Europe. I mean, it is the supreme player in Europe. I don't believe it's Nazi in any way, shape, or form. You know, I believe today's Germany is democratic, liberal, at the moment open-minded. So I don't believe that the attitude remains. But the industrialists who made most of the plant and machinery for the Nazis in World War II, those families still exist. Those families are still immensely wealthy, and those families still have a huge amount of influence. So the money didn't disappear. It's still there. It's back in Germany.
And there was a fair amount of gold that went missing as well, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the idea that there's still a load of physical gold is probably... there are some hoards, there are treasure hoards distinctly in Germany, Lake Toplitz and various other places that I could take people to if they were interested in financing an expedition to recover Nazi gold. I know where it is. I've got the satellite information and the information from people on the ground to show me where there is hundreds of billions of dollars of missing gold and treasures. However, most of it went to Switzerland, was turned into telegraphic transfer money, and was used that way. So the idea that, especially from 1943, when they, and then in 1944 after D-Day, they lost their physical ability to get stuff out through Spain and Portugal because there was no overland line to it anymore. And then when Italy was closed down by the Americans and the Brits, there was nowhere to go via Austria into Italy and via the Mediterranean out to Argentina. So the physical gold went to Switzerland, where the Swiss just changed it for changed it for money. And you could, even in those days, you could make a telegraphic transfer for millions. You know, you just have to have your ID card or your eight-figure Swiss bank account number. You know that gold I've got? Well, I'd like that to actually transfer in cash to Argentina. Of course, Mr. Borman. When would you like it done, sir?
Yeah, and so you're saying also, too, that a lot of the assets that were acquired by the Nazis were then turned around and redeployed in Germany. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
After the war.
After the war, yes. But, I mean, in terms of treasure, you know, the missing amber room and the Polish gold train and all the rest of that stuff, yes, there is a small amount of what the Nazis nicked still out there. About a third of the treasures that were stolen in Europe. So that's artwork, I don't know, everything else, mainly artworks. It's still out there somewhere. And probably in the private homes of former SS officers. And it'll turn up one day in a couple of hundred years' time when there are no members of the Jewish families that were stolen from to claim recuperation or repatriation or reparations. Sorry, excuse my lack of English there for a moment.
No problem.
But, and there is some missing treasure. I mean, as I say, I'm aware of about eight places where there is physical treasure in Germany, which is gettable. I'd have to give a lot of it back to the German government, but it's still gettable. If anybody wants to fancy going on a treasure hunt with me, just come up with the money, guys. there you go. But the real money wasn't shipped in terms of putting it on a boat to Argentina or to Brazil or to Turkey or to Egypt or to Syria. It was simply transferred to banks in that area. You know, this is something we do today without even thinking about it. You know, you do PayPal. Well, you know, there was the equivalent of PayPal or international money transfers or SWIFT transfers or whatever back in the day. And the Germans used it. You know, the German central banker and sat on the committee of the International Bank of Settlements at the same time as Britain's head of the Bank of England did, all the way through the war. All the way through the war, those bankers were talking to each other. There's a wonderful book by a colleague of mine whose name escapes me, but the book is called The Tower of Basel, which is a whole expose of the work of the International Bank of Settlements, which your financier listeners would, I think, find fascinating. You know, there's Schacht, who was the German central bank governor, and the man who ran the Bank of England were homosexual lovers and had been since they'd been in university together in the 30s. And they still sat on the International Bank of Settlements Committee. So, I mean, you can't drive an operation like the Nazis without backing, without money.
Right.
Any more than you can drive a presidential campaign in America without backing, you know, if it isn't some shadowy billionaire or there's only one of the Koch brothers left now, isn't there? But, you know, people like that who fund politicians and fund ideas, fund ideologies. We have it here now as well. Unfortunately, they all seem to be right wing.
I'm sorry, you know, go ahead.
No, we seem to have forgotten a lot of the lessons of the 30s in our politics currently, both in those two great engines of democracy, they were called in World War II, the United States and Great Britain. I don't see either of them being that anymore. I hope to God it all changes. Because we have not learned the lessons from the 1930s. We have not learned that you can put people in power who are dangerous. Our parliament is fighting incredibly hard to stop an unelected advisor to Boris Johnson, the current prime minister, but not for very long, trying to destroy our country, not just in my opinion by leaving the European Union, but in many people's opinions by leaving the European Union. In the way that they're trying to leave it, this whole idea of no deal. And they're taking things straight out of Goebbels' playbook, you know, and running the propaganda side of things. And if you don't know your history, what is it you will, if you don't read history, you will never learn from the mistakes that were made then. And well, we've got the same mistakes happening all over the world as we did in the 1930s now. And to see them happening in those two great powerhouse engines of democracy that kicked Nazi butt and Imperial Japanese butt during World War II is the saddest thing I think I've ever seen in 40 years as a journalist. It's just really sad.
So I have a couple of follow-up questions here that I jotted down as you were speaking over the last 45 minutes. I want to just circle back to them if you don't mind.
Sorry, Chris, I don't get on much.
What? No, that's all right. No. You're like Howard Stern says, we're free to be you and me. You know, you just go nuts, lose your shit, do whatever you got to do. It's all right. I totally understand. I want to go back to the Soviets claiming that they found a piece of Hitler's skull, which I thought was a peculiar part of the story that stood out to me. And I wanted to know if you could just kind of flesh out when that happened. And then, of course, now this has been disproven through forensics, but what the motivation behind that may have been at the time that it was, at the time that they claimed to have part of his skull.
Well, I mean, I think that came out in the 70s, maybe the 80s, that they had part of his skull. Up until that time, they said they'd never found anything.
Right.
Could have been Adolf Hitler. It's a really good question. I mean, I can understand why the British had Hugh Trevor Roper write his last days of Hitler in 1945, right? And so the guy was dead, committed suicide, and these are the informations I have. Because they wanted it to be over. They wanted to draw a line under World War II. There is a huge amount of information in the Soviet Union about the last days of World War II. In fact, I was offered the visitor book from the bunker about 8 years ago for a ridiculous amount of money, which showed who people who had visited Hitler in the final 3 weeks of his time in Berlin, which would have made fascinating reading. But, you know, I've got $100,000 to pay some idiot for it, but he wasn't an idiot. He was an ex-CIA operative who was doing very well in the Soviet Union at the time. There's a huge amount of information that could come out of the Soviet Union and probably never will do, because people just go, oh, there are more important things. And there probably are more important things now to worry about. All the information from British security, which I've tried to get at in the National Archives in Kew here, has been stamped, I think 4 or 5 years ago, it was stamped as top secret for another 50 years. So it'll outlive me. So you can't get at that information. There's a massive amount of information that was destroyed in a big fire at a CIA warehouse in the 1950s, which was relevant to operations happening in Germany at the end of 1945, or from April 45 on. So the Soviets, the FSB, which is now their equivalent of the KGB, have actually called me a liar in print. And I went back, and luckily the newspaper published it. And I said, well, if I'm a liar, please prove me a liar. Release the teeth to independent DNA examiner. Release the skull fragment to independent DNA examination. You know, the Argentines, because of their dirty war in the 1970s, where their people killed over 30,000 of their own people, whether their junta, their Nazis, killed 30,000 of their own people, in the Henry Kissinger-sponsored dirty war, and are the leading people in DNA examination in the world. And, you know, there is no reason Argentina isn't a close friend of the United States and not a close friend of the Soviet Union. Let the Argentine scientists go in and do it. At least they come out with the truth. But the Soviets will not release the information, because I don't know why. Maybe make them look stupid, whatever. But they won't. They won't let us get at that information. The British government won't let us get at that information. And that could be for many, many reasons, because there were so many dirty deals done at the end of World War II between the Allied governments and the rump Nazi organization that it would change everybody's approach to certain things. You can't trust governments to tell you the truth. Did I just say that? Do I mean that? Yes, funnily enough, I do mean that. You cannot tell them, you cannot trust governments to tell you the truth, even when you vote for the damn people.
Well, and governments around the world have a long history of not telling the truth. I mean, that's, you know,
yeah,
we're not going out on a limb there.
I mean, if you, yeah, I think you were going on a bit of a limb there. I mean, the one with me is UFOs. I don't know whether UFOs are examples of alien visitors to this world or not. I mean, I haven't spent 12 years looking at it. But the government knows. The US and the British government and the French, they all know. Why do you think France is building a space force and America is building a space force and things like that? But will they tell you? They won't tell you. You know, it doesn't matter who gets into power. I think even the orange Cheeto guy, what's his name, your president at the moment? Him. He said that, you know, when he got into power, he would enable everybody to find out the truth about UFOs. Nothing. Not a word. Nada. Not even a flipping tweet. So if they can hide and give us misinformation on topics that people are really interested in, it's very easy to lie about things that have happened 75 years ago. I mean, Goebbels, it could have been Hitler, but Goebbels was the guy who's quoted usually for it, is the man who said, if you tell a lie loudly enough and long enough, it becomes the truth.
Sure.
And sadly,
go ahead.
It's true. And sadly, that is true. You lie long enough and loudly enough about something, people will accept it as the truth.
Oh, yeah. We watch companies do it all the time on Wall Street. And that's...
not just on Wall Street.
You know, that's... it's one of the recurring themes in the financial world, which is, you know, like you said, say it boldly enough and say it loudly enough. And
yeah, you know, I was a business journalist for a while in the City of London. So, and, you know, actually have family who work in the city as well, which I won't go into detail because they might get recognized. But yeah, I mean, I recognize, you know, you'd get somebody's IPO documents, you look at it and you go, really? You're going to say that?
Right. Yeah, and more so now than...
That was pre-Google, man.
Right. But now it's just you know, several standard deviations in the wrong direction of just nonsense and craziness. But I don't want to lose the thread, though. I want to go back to something that you mentioned about... I have a couple more questions. First off, what is the guest book to the Führer Bunker doing just... hanging out there somewhere, so that
there's a warehouse full of stuff recovered from Berlin in 1945, which under the early days of Putin, they sold a load of this stuff to oligarchs, and one of the oligarchs picked up this KGB warehouse full of information on the last days of Hitler and the last days of the Soviets. So all the books, all the information, all the code machines, all the intercepts, everything is in this, well, I think it probably still is, it was 8 years ago, in this place in Moscow, which is now owned by a very wealthy man who was trying to make some more money out of it, but never did. But they just flogged it off to the private sector. So that's where that is.
So everything's kind of floating around out there, all of these pieces of evidence that could help make or break your case are just... have randomly kind of gone through channels through to private people?
Some of them have. I mean, in Argentina, for instance, there was a, I would regularly come across in antique shops in central Buenos Aires, government documents from the 1940s and 1950s, which had all been sold on, including one, which was the complete list and interrogation reports of the Graf Spee crew members off the pocket battleship that got destroyed in Uruguay, and then the men surrendered in Argentina, and all that was just sitting there in a shop in Buenos Aires. I mean, right next door to various Nazi symbols, a whole bunch of Nazi medals and Jewish menorah, you know, the candlestick things. Really weird. I mean, they don't have in Argentina, they simply don't have that sense of World War II that especially we in Britain still have, and we in Europe still have. I think in some ways the Pacific is a bigger thing in America. The war you guys fought in the Pacific is a bigger thing in America, but God knows you put enough boys on the ground in Europe to help save our asses. But you can just pick this stuff up randomly. And again, I think the guy wanted $1,500, which I wasn't willing to pay for the original, but I took a lot of photographs and still have them. So it details everybody who surrendered to the Argentine authorities and their interrogation reports. But it's not available in the National Archives because somebody's flogged it.
One of the other things that was touched on in the documentary that I thought was fascinating that you mentioned very early on when we first started talking were the Nazi tunnel systems. And wasn't there, possibly incorrectly, but wasn't there a theory that they had tunneled out of the bunker all the way to Argentina?
That would just be silly. That's thousands of miles. What they did have was access to the underground railway network in Berlin, which was extensive. So they were able to come out of a tunnel in the bunker into the underground network, walk whatever it was, about 10, 12 kilometers to an area where there was an aircraft waiting for them on the Hohenzollern-Damm, which is a big, wide freeway-type road in Berlin. So the underground tunnels were used, but only the underground they didn't build them in Berlin. They existed. It would like be using, you know, the New York subway to get out.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know New York that well, but I mean, yeah. Let's if you're a bunkers in the Bronx and you want to get to Queens or something, you just go down the tunnel and walk it.
Yeah, but they didn't create their own network of tunnels.
They created, well, I mean, you know, underground Nazi Germany is huge. There are massive bunkers, emplacements and things that still haven't been investigated all over Nazi Germany. But in terms of them getting out on a tunnel, they only got out of the Führerbunker area to another part of Berlin via tunnels. There are no tunnels leading anywhere else.
Because there was another fringe theory, too, which I'm sure... I don't know enough about to comment, but there was like another fringe theory that they had all just gone underground. They had taken all of the, you know, the top military officials and rounded up, you know, 50,000 people and just lived underground, right?
Yeah, in the Antarctic. I mean, I know it's not a phrase you use in America, but it's complete and total bollocks.
Yeah. we know
total
what that means.
Total bollocks. Right. I mean, the whole idea that in 1945 you could get enough German surface vessels or submarines from Germany down to the Antarctic, where waiting for you were 300,000 committed Nazis. It's just complete one-handed typing in a bedroom somewhere. I don't know whether you get that idea, but there's some guy using only one hand to type in a bedroom, making this rubbish up. Because he gets off on it.
Right.
And no. And again, anybody out there who's got a flat earth theory or wants to tell me about the tunnels in Antarctica and has got documented proof and pictures and everything else that are real, I'd more than happily listen to them. But it is complete and total bollocks.
Does it agitate you that the work that you've done kind of gets conflated with that nonsense, because that was part of the same episode.
I know. I wasn't happy about it, but I didn't have editorial control over it. What annoys me is that it's like a smokescreen, and because it's sexy, it deflects people away from the reality of the information that's available.
Right.
You know, it's much sexier to have underground bases in the Antarctica serviced by Nazi flying saucers and, you know, wonder weapons, and that's so sexy. They've still got smart boots and they're still wearing Hugo Boss style uniforms, and it's not quite so sexy when they are getting off a submarine after 28 days filthy, stinking and dirty, and then going to live on a farm in Argentina. That's nowhere near as sexy as going down to the Antarctic and living in an area that is, you know, subtropical. Yeah, okay. Or underground, and has Nazi scientists who are much cleverer than anybody else we've ever had being able to live in the Antarctic. Unfortunately, the phrase "it's complete bollocks" comes back to me all the time. And what it does is it distracts from serious investigation.
Right.
Because I've had to go and look at all those. There's a long interview with Admiral Byrd, who took an American task force down there in the 50s. But he took the American task force down there in the 50s to train American soldiers in cold weather warfare. And that suddenly became, no, Byrd was hunting for Nazi bases down there. Right. Three of his aircraft shot out of the sky by some beam weapon. And no, they weren't. Show me the proof. Not just one supposed interview with Admiral Byrd, which appears in a Uruguay newspaper. The problem is you have to go and check every single one of these details before you can dismiss it. Or I do, anyway. Unless it's, you know, ridiculous, like they've got a base on the moon. But otherwise, you have to go back and check these details. I mean, the whole Antarctic thing comes from the German word for countries in the south, like Argentina and Chile. They are seen as being close to the Arctic. And that's where this whole Antarctic theory comes from. Well, it's not even a theory. It's just so crass.
Right. What is the most traction you've gotten with your research from the academic community, from, you know, the conventional historian community? You know, where have you seen the most promise in trying to get your research out there?
We've had a couple of people say, gosh, this is interesting. But most of them, I mean, I'll give you an example. There's a man called Guy Walters in the UK who wrote a book called Hunting Evil, which is about hunting Nazis in South America. And it's, in my opinion, it's not a very good, very well-researched book. But he turns up on the pages of the Daily Mail, which is one of the big newspapers in this country, mainly because he's an old Etonian type who's friendly with the editor. And they use him as the go-to Nazi guy. So Guy Walters, when Grey Wolf was published, came out, set himself up as a historian, expert on the Nazis and everything else, describes Grey Wolf as being 1,000% wrong, and then goes on to repeat the accepted history. 3 days later, after his article is published, Walters contacts Sterling in New York and asks for a copy of the book so he can read it. Yeah, I mean, it's 1,000% wrong, and that's all over, you know, the Daily Mail. And Guy Walters says this is 1,000%. What's wrong with 100% wrong?
Right, yeah.
And if it's 100% wrong, prove it. Show me where my research and Simon Dunson's research is made up, is ridiculous, is rubbish. Show me. Because that's all we've done is present the case. I'd love to have done this in a court of law. I mean, I think there's still $1 million, $1,945 million, available from Congress for proof that Adolf Hitler did die. Somebody said they'd pay $1 million if somebody'd come up with proof that Hitler was dead. It's never been claimed. I don't think they probably put it in account that was interest-bearing, unfortunately.
No, I don't think so either.
That story's out there, you know, $1 million offered for the final story on the death of Adolf Hitler, and nobody ever claims it.
Have you gotten any traction with anybody from the academic community at all?
No, it's been dismissed out of hand, and very often it's been dismissed out of hand by people who simply won't be bothered to read what we've written. And I find that more irritating than anything, I think.
Right.
It's, you know, I read their crap.
If you were gonna try to poke a hole in your own research, you know, I've got
my smoking gun. You know, where is my smoking gun? Where is my proof that Adolf Hitler died in Argentina on February 12, 1962, of a heart attack after having a number of strokes in previous days? Where is my proof? Where is his body? Well, I've been told by various people, but never put it in writing, so I can't prove it, that Hitler was cremated in 1962, and that Alan Dulles' sister actually attended the funeral. Eleanor Lansing Dulles, who was head of the German head of the German desk at State post-war. And she resigned in 1962, never been overseas apart from to Germany. And first thing she does is fly to Argentina. Of course, let's go on holiday to Argentina, Eleanor. But, I mean, she's just part of the thing. She was there paying the family's respects to the dead Führer. But I've got no smoking gun. I've got no proof. I've got video interviews with witnesses who saw him, who waited on him, who knew where he lived. But people don't want to believe those witnesses, although they will believe witnesses that Hugh Trevor Roper never even interviewed.
Right.
So where is your rigor? Where is your academic rigor? Where is your journalistic rigor in just dismissing what we've written? I mean, the book sold, 100,000 copies in English. I think it's been pirated about 40,000 times by some dubious Russian website, so I'll never see any money out of that. And, out there in 16, 17 countries. So there are people out there who have bothered to read it, but as far as the main academic spectrum is concerned, no. I'll just give you an example. Hugh Trevor Roper, right? He's the guy who later on in life identified the Hitler Diaries as being real. The Hitler Diaries was a big scandal in the 1970s in the British press. The Sunday Times were going to publish them, and Trevor Roper said they were real. They were written in Bic Biro, which wasn't even invented in the 1940s. And, they would have things like, oh, woke up, Shag Deva invaded Russia. Really? And this guy said they were real. my best friend, my best buddy for 47 years, his dad is a professor of medieval history, very senior professor of medieval history. And I adored my friend's parents a great deal. They're lovely people. Unfortunately, they died before, he died, the professor died before Grey Wolf was published, because I would have loved to have seen him read it and give me hell.
Sure.
For whatever. I just want somebody to give me hell on it. But his wife outlasted the professor a long time, and I'd always called her Mrs. whatever, and I think in my 40s she said, I think you can call me Patricia now, Gerard, because I was 40-something, and I'm still calling her by her... the name I show respect for. And I asked her if she ever had met Hugh Trevor Roper. And she said, oh, God, yes, we had to sit next to him at dinners in Oxford a number of times. I said, what was he like? And she turned to me and she went, a total prat. And for her to use that sort of language was just great for me. But, if they won't bother to come and talk to us, if they won't bother to actually... show me how they're right and I'm wrong. What can I do?
Right. Yeah. I have Go ahead.
No, I can't stand up in the middle of a square in Oxford and Cambridge and go, historians, can you come and tell me how basically we're so wrong? I'd love them to. Well, and rip them apart.
So if I can find somebody that wants to challenge you, will you come back on and will we have a debate?
Please do.
Because, I don't have a huge listener base, but I imagine that there may be somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody. Opportunity arise, you'll commit to doing that?
As long as they have read the book beforehand.
Sure. Okay. We can qualify.
That's all I ask, is read the book beforehand and then have a go at me. What I won't do is come up and debate with so-called mainstream historians who have not bothered to look at the information.
Okay, very good. Look, to wrap it up,
sometimes it's like being a man in a born-again Christian church who says, I don't believe in Jesus. And these are the reasons why I don't believe in Jesus. And, they just run you out of town on a rail. Because they do believe, and it does come down to a belief system on the other side for me. And I'm going, I love your belief system. I love the fact you believe Hugh Trevor Roper. But, and there are big buts all over this. Theo Chris, that's one way for me to spend a Sunday morning is ranting at you.
Look, the last thing I want to cover, and I'm gonna let you go, and I appreciate it so much, you taking your time.
It's a pleasure.
You just spoke about some of the details of Hitler's death in 1962. Where do we get those details from? You know, how do you come up with he had a heart attack and several strokes? And
yeah, they come from the notes of his personal doctor, Otto Lehmann, who I've since discovered isn't his real name. He was the former chief medical officer for the German army, who ended up in Bariloche looking after various Germans. Hitler was one of his patients, I understand. And his notes were passed to Captain Monasterio, this Argentine former congressman and commercial naval officer, who passed them to us.
And we have no... Are there photographs of Hitler in Argentina after the war?
Yeah, I believe there are. And I've come tantalizingly close to some on various occasions. the one I thought was really going to work out for us, a lady who lived in Cordoba province who said she had pictures of him in the 50s and a dated and signed copy of Mein Kampf from 1953. She was told by a phone call from somebody in her German community that the Gestapo quotes were still active and that if she didn't stop speaking to these damned English people, I'm not English, by the way, I'm Welsh, which is a big thing for me, that they would kill her. End of story. And she never spoke to us again after telling us why she was scared. Again, the son of a German Nazi SS general who moved to Argentina at the end of the war. He had promised one of my contacts a bunch of pictures of Hitler. He got a bunch of pictures of Hitler. Unfortunately, I knew exactly what those pictures were, and they were mainly pictures of Hitler visiting his old cell in the prison in Berlin. And when I said, actually, here are the originals of those pictures, taken by Hitler's personal photographer at the prison, he stopped talking to me.
So what could be the key piece of evidence that really unlocks the door for you, and is it out there?
Well, his surviving daughter, who could be living in America, could tell us and show us the family snapshots. That would help. People in Argentina could stop being so scared, and they are, of what these Nazi organizations might do to them, and start delivering sensible pictures and information. I don't know, somebody might be able to crack it wide open. I mean, now with Photoshop and everything else, it's very difficult unless you get your hands physically on the photograph, check the paper and everything else. And Chris, I'll be honest with you, I don't have the finances to do that level of forensic work on things now. We did when we were doing Grey Wolf, and we had, you know, we proved that it was Adolf Hitler's double in the last pictures of Hitler ever taken. We used a professor to do that and various other forensic work. But even if I got a picture of Hitler, you know, I'd probably get it on the web. I'd need to get the original, have the paper checked, have the chemicals used to develop that picture checked. It would have to be looked at under pretty much an electron microscope. And I'd need to get all the provenance I could from the person who delivered that picture to me.
Right.
I don't know if that'll ever happen. Yeah, I don't know if that'll ever happen. There is part of me that just wants to walk away from this. It might not sound it, but there is part of me that just wants to walk away, because, you know, I think that we have presented our case. I can't do much more, not unless somebody wants to give me a couple of $1 million and let me hire, you know, Lenny DePaul, my good friend from Hunting Hitler, and the Manhunter from the U.S. Marshals, and Tim Kennedy, preferably as security, Captain America. Somebody wants to pay for a major investigation, a proper one, into it. Yeah, I think I might do it, but it would have to be. I can't afford to. I got to go do other things.
Sure.
And
is there still a Nazi presence in Argentina?
Yeah, you know it. there's so much money involved.
Right.
And that's what it comes down to, is that there is so much money involved that the children of the Nazis who went out there are at my age, you know, they're 60, 70, whatever. And they're the ones who benefited from the private education, the international education, the money that came out with their mums and dads. And it's now their children who are the shareholders in BMW and Porsche and the baby Farbens and, you know, all Volkswagen and Hugo Boss and all the other German companies, Siemens, that still survive to this day. You can't get hold of lists of their shareholders. It's quite interesting. They have a different approach to transparency in the German economy than Americans or Brits do. So you can't find out who owns half of these companies. But it, when you look back at it, they're owned pretty much by senior Nazis and senior Nazi industrialists, some of whom are still in Germany, some of whom who fled and took their money with them, and the kids or the grandkids now have that money. So they don't want the truth to come out. They just don't. I mean, you know, they want it all to have stopped in Berlin in 1945, not in Argentina in 1962.
Well, listen, the book is called Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. Thank you so much, Gerard, for coming on this morning and spending an hour and a half with me going over this stuff. I hope it does stoke some interest. And of course, if you'd like to take a moment, if there's anything else of yours that you feel like my listeners should check out, certainly I'll put a link to the book in the podcast description so people can click through if they're interested in the subject material. Is there anything else that you would recommend that listeners...
I also write World War II fiction, funnily enough, because that way I get to kill Nazis in my books. So on Amazon you'll find a couple of Gerard Williams' World War II fiction books, which are, yeah, if you want a bit of a romp, they're fun. It was a good distraction not being able to kill Nazis while working on Grey Wolf. So I got my characters to kill them anyway.
Well, listen, I certainly appreciate you taking the interview kind of sight unseen. And, you know, hopefully you get some traction, excuse me, for my listeners. And would love to have you back on again, hopefully at some point. Do you plan on publishing anything further on this topic going forward?
We're working on the sequel at the moment. It's been quite difficult to get a publisher to pick it up. In fact, one major American publisher was so worried about the revelations about the Vatican and Pope Pius that he was scared that there were aspects in American society that would burn down bookshops because it was being published. That's a direct quote. So it's difficult to find, despite the fact we sold over 100,000 copies of the book in English, it's still difficult to find a publisher who'll take on the spider's web. And that really is the more political and financial aspect of what actually happened to the Nazi wealth after World War II, and who in America, especially, unfortunately, Britain was too bruised by World War II to really, yeah, they got some things, but they didn't get very much. But people find the subject matter too difficult to handle. So there you go. It all comes down to money, Chris, one way or another. Yep. And thank you very much for having me, letting me rant at you on a Sunday morning.
Of course. Yeah, of course. And, you know, if you can't find a publisher, you're more than welcome to come on and talk about what you found. And hopefully you will. I'm sure that you will, and would love to have you back on. So let's stay in touch. All right.
All right, Chris. You take care.
Right. And, thank you.
Thanks very much. See you, Angelus.
Thank you, Gerard. That was the one, the only Gerard Williams. So kind of him to come on and speak to me, especially after not really introducing myself too well to him. I just sent him a message and said, hey, come on the podcast, talk. I saw you on Netflix and found you fascinating and found the subject material very interesting. And in keeping with my editorial decision for the podcast to just bring on whoever the hell I want and talk about whatever I want, I was delighted that he was able to come on this morning and talk about it. Certainly, I have a list of like 15 unanswered questions here that I didn't want to take the rest of his day, but certainly am looking forward to reading his book. And I will be back early next week. I believe I have Whitney Webb coming back. I'm trying to get the date set Thank you guys so much for listening. As always, thank you to my patrons for continuing to donate to the podcast to keep me going. Maybe we talk some Epstein, and we'll definitely talk some finance next week. But it is the first NFL Sunday. I got to get to the gym and get my workout in so that I can be a lazy pile of shit and watch some football in a little bit. For now, I am out. Peace!